everybody. Hi. Welcome to the second day of the China Africa series. It's not working. Hello? Is that better? Okay. So I assume quite a few of you were here last night. I see some faces I saw last night, so I'm going to just sort of continue on from where we ended yesterday and hope you can all just follow on. The majority of today's talk will just be on the contemporary situation of China, Africa. We'll look at some instances of aid, some instances of security, and then we will wrap it up. As I mentioned yesterday, and you probably all know, China's presence in Africa is quite contentious, and particularly if you are a reader of English newspapers from Europe, America, even South Africa, you often get quite a negative view of the Chinese coming to Africa. A recent sort of example in South Africa was in Noseweek. Noseweek had I don't know if anyone saw it, an edition called The Chinese Are Coming, and how you're going to find one in each town, and it was sort of tantamount to some kind of yellow peril invasion of some sort. I've got some other examples here. A Daily Mail, which is a British sort of right-wing tabloid, it's a headline, How China is Taking Over Africa and Why the West Should Be Very Worried. And it goes on to say, a strategy has been carefully devised by officials in Beijing, where one expert has estimated that China will eventually need to send 300 million people to Africa to solve the problems of overpopulation and pollution. So there are these kinds of rumors. One is that, China is sort of grooming Africa as a kind of, proto-satellite colony where they will send overflow of Chinese people to work there. I mean, I've heard that one. Quite a common one, which I've heard recently by a few people, is that the Chinese use prisoners as labor. You might have heard this story. The Chinese use prisoners as labor in Africa. And I've heard two guys. One told me about how he heard about it in Mozambique. I think someone else in Zambia. Today, there's no evidence of that. One of the theories is that the way that Chinese people work in very modest means, they stick within their little enclaves, they work in quite regimented fashion, is that perhaps some of the locals mistook them for prisoners, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, I've got another quote here. This is from I actually took this off the internet today on Politics Web. It's a Zimbabwean commentator. He wrote this about 2 weeks ago. He says, our politicians continue to tell us how the imperialists want to destroy Africa and keep it underdeveloped. But right on our doorstep is de facto Chinese imperialism. I think our liberation struggle political parties have been naive to believe that looking east will create an advantageous economic relations compared with the West. Personally, I have not yet heard of any African country which has developed rapidly because of the involvement of the Chinese. Yes, they have built infrastructure in Africa, but the cost to our future generations is unimaginable. Their economic agenda is that of extending as much wealth and value out of Africa as possible. It's all about them. So there are voices within Africa who are quite critical of China, and the idea is quite simple, that they're here to extract resources, and everything else they do is mere fluff, stuff on the surface. That is their intention, and we need to be very vigilant. Like I mentioned yesterday, a lot of African leaders themselves don't feel that way because, well, they receive the money from the Chinese and it often helps them maintain their political position if they do. Just on the opposite side, and this is a side that in the West we don't really care about unless you're a fan of reading Chinese newspapers, but the way that Chinese presence in Africa is reported within China is unsurprisingly very different to how it's reported in Africa. So this is like a typical headline of China Africa. I took this from Xinhua, which is the state-run Chinese newspaper. The title is China Africa Friendship Enhanced by Diverse Growing Cooperation. It says the friendship between the world's largest developing country and the continent's home to mostly developing countries has lasted over 60 years and touched the lives of 2.3 billion people. With the good Well, and joint efforts of both China and Africa, the unique relationship between the two sides has an even brighter future ahead. And also in the People's Daily the other day, another quote, just quickly, it says, as is known to all, Western powers, not China, colonized Africa and looted resources there in history. So from the Chinese side, you get the sense that it's a very benevolent, coming from a good place, bestowing gifts upon the African people. Whereas from the West, it's very different. So we're going to look a bit more about what China's up to in Africa today. I'm going to discuss some details of different aid projects and different instances of the Chinese presence in Africa, and then make a summary. My summary is we'll see, but I'm not as critical of the Chinese as most. That doesn't mean that I'm, how should I say, fully in favor of their full-scale proto-colonization of Africa, but I think it's a bit more complicated. We'll talk about it in a bit. Now, in terms of Chinese development, I don't know if you... Sorry, I just concluded this. Does anyone know what this is? No? It's the new African Union building, which was recently constructed in Addis Ababa, and the money came from the Chinese, and the construction materials. In fact, if you look at the Great Wall of the People in China, it looks quite similar to this. Anyway, I was there recently. It's quite impressive. But 22, what was the price of it? I think it can't be 22 million. It must have been more than that. Anyway, a lot of money. Apparently, rumors were that 90% of it was constructed by Chinese workers. But apparently, I've heard from other people that that's not true. It was actually far more Ethiopian workers engaged in it. Anyway, this is an example of basically bad Chinese developments in Africa. And this is a housing estate that was built in Angola. And you know, the Chinese have a very significant presence in Angola. Remember yesterday we talked about how the Chinese fell out of Angola. Well, since the 2000s, they broke a lot of very significant oil deals with Angola and now have a very strong presence. And one of these was a state-owned company, which is called the China International Trust and Investment Corporation, decided to build a satellite city on the outskirts of Luanda, the capital. And it was an unmitigated disaster. It's called Nova Cidade de Quilomba. I think that's Quilomba. So it was 758-story buildings. The project cost £2.2 billion. And flats going for about $150,000 to $300,000 for one, and nobody's moved in, so it's become like a ghost city. And it's funny because this project is often bounced around in the media. Last year it was in the media quite a lot as a sort of example of how Chinese investment has gone terribly wrong. And admittedly, it is an example of a bad investment. Basically, as some of you might know, Luanda is one of the most expensive cities in the world. The developer probably thought that there was enough cash to go around to put up something like this, and people will use it, but at present it's derelict. The thing is, I guess one point you have to make is within China itself, you get similar failed property developments. So this one is one in Inner Mongolia, which again was a huge city built, which no one moved into. And I hope it's not the same developer, because that would be a big trouble. My point is, I think that a lot of the things that people are critical about the Chinese in Africa happens within China itself. If you look at the way that labor regulation works in China, laborers have to work incredibly long hours, they get incredibly low pay. They eat very modestly, they don't go out, they sort of stay in their compounds. In Western China, where you see them doing developments there, you see similar patterns, and you see that in Africa. So in some senses, it's. I think this again is this thing of like, oh, they bring prisoners here, and this sort of, the truth is that the Chinese style of working, they've sort of grafted on this earlier socialist model of sort of really rigorous, harsh, almost militant disciplinarism, disciplinary approach to labor, And they've sort of grafted it onto this industrial capitalist model, and that's how they work, in this very sort of militant fashion. So possibly that's one way that they they think that they're prisoners. Anyway, so this is a disaster. So I just thought I'd start off with this as a very bad example of Chinese investments in Africa. And move on to another one. This is a more common form of investment. So when China says they're going to dish out aid to Africa and they give you figures, often what this entails is basically there will be some sort of resource, be it copper, oil, or whatever it may be, and China will come and say, right, we want to develop your oil and we'll build a refinery or whatever, and they'll say, okay, well, we want roads and stuff in exchange. And the Chinese will build these, they use their own companies, and they usually pay back with the actual commodity itself, like oil or copper or something. So just to give you an example, in the Congo in 2008, there's a DRC company called Gecko Mines. The Gecko Mines was formed by a partnership of a Congolese state-owned company called Sika Mines and two Chinese companies, the Sinohydro, which is a big dam-building Chinese state-owned enterprise, and China Railway Engineering Corporation. And the idea was for the government to lease land containing minerals with copper and cobalt in the southern province of Katanga, producing potential revenues of $45 to $100 billion. In exchange for development aid, which the Chinese would refer to as a win-win situation or a mutual benefit situation. They're very fond of these terms. The deal was originally, it was $9 billion deal, which is astronomical amounts of money. And it is funded by China's Exim Bank. So China has these very large development banks. The Exim Bank, which its proper name is the Chinese Import-Export Bank, is flush with money. I don't know how many billions it has, but it shoulders the risk for investing in places where most investors wouldn't go. So they put up that money, and so when the companies go in, they know that they're backed by a very powerful development bank. And I think this helps the Chinese go into these sort of frontier regions to invest. The deal was originally $9 billion, but $6 billion was to be invested in infrastructure, $3 billion for mining. Much of this could be paid in copper and cobalt itself. Now, some Westerners are critical of this, but actually they have also been known to do deals in Africa where they also are paid back in commodities. A total of 6,000 kilometers of road would be built or rehabilitated. Two hospitals and two universities were to be built. Firstly, the IMF, because the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, who are the usual donors, they didn't like this deal. And the reason they didn't like this deal is because they felt that the Congo already owed them so much money that they shouldn't be taking out other loans. And so I think through IMF pressure, eventually the Chinese had to drop the amount of the loan to, I think it was $6 or $7 billion, so they had to shave off a bit. This one in the Congo is quite typical of others that have happened, Nigeria, Angola, Sudan, and elsewhere. Now, the criticisms for these kinds of things, there's a global witness report on this particular deal in the Congo, and apparently the signatory papers are highly opaque, and there's all sorts of irregularities. Including a $24 million signing bonus, which goes to Gecko Mines bosses. Apparently, there's no transparency in it. I mean, this is we can talk about this a bit later, but this is not something specific to Chinese companies doing deals with things like oil and copper and whatnot in Africa. I mean, a lot of Western companies are engaged in some dodgy business there too. Also, there were no feasibility studies published outlining environmental impact. The Chinese, and again, you know, Westerners, which have a very advanced network of NGOs in Africa, will look at the Chinese and say, oh, well, you're not doing environmental impact, you don't have very strong protection of labor laws or worker safety. But again, if you go to China, it's very much the same there. It's not as if they're just doing this in Africa because it's, I don't know, it's some developing world place. Like in China, the environmental standards are very low, and in China, the labor laws are also very lax. So they're just kind of doing what they're doing at home. Some people have said that, actually, as China does more business in Africa, they're actually going to be exposed there to best practices more than they would at home. In other words, because of all the pressure of NGOs and whatnot, one of the first places they're going to learn how to do better environmental assessments or better labor regulation is in places like Africa, because there's NGOs crawling all over that are going to be on them and writing reports. And in some cases, they have really been caught thinking, oh, well, we didn't even know that. You know, and suddenly we've got some non-government organization writing media reports about us not doing this or that. Because in China, they don't do that. There are a few NGOs, but they're not actual, the sense non-government. They're government, non-government organizations. So it's also highly likely, based on other examples, that the roads which these companies will build are to get the commodities out. So I don't know if anyone, I mean, I don't know the DRC very well, but basically it's a very huge country and there's no roads or railway anymore connecting the east and the west. The way people travel is on the Congo River by boat, that's the main. So it would be crucial that this road would be built nevertheless, because it's going to go from Katanga province in the south to Kinshasa. And this is to get the minerals out. But of course the counter argument is, well, once you have a road, people will adapt to it anyway, and it will connect new villages and people who otherwise weren't connected to markets into those markets, offer them better access to cities and whatnot to do trade. So, you know, there's that situation. These kinds of loan agreements are very attractive to many African leaders who are strapped for cash. And basically, they've also shone a light on, and we mentioned this yesterday, the structural adjustment loans of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And these sorts of ones were putting emphasis on eliminating subsidies and controls on imports, wages, and prices, devaluing local currencies and letting the market determine the price for raw materials. And this emphasis on transparency and accountability, and how this was actually a big failure in Africa, and how we saw so much corruption even with all these things in place. So in some ways, it can be argued that the Chinese way of doing this is perhaps a better way. Another way in which the Chinese have tried to develop Africa, another experiment, is these special economic zones. This is one we visited in Addis Ababa. So I mentioned yesterday that sort of when China began its economic liberalization, it began in one part of China, in the south, and it worked, and then they replicated elsewhere and elsewhere. So the Chinese, when they do kinds of social and economic change, they have very a cautious approach to it, and they'll do it in one contained area as a sort of experiment, and if it works, they replicate it. And they've done this in Africa through setting up these special economic zones, which I think in principle are a good idea. This was fascinating because I was in Addis Ababa, and they took us to the outside of Addis Ababa, and we entered this Chinese special economic zone. And as you enter it, just spatially, everything looks like China. The way the roads are, the way the flowers are meticulously planted.